It's Great Mondays Radio. I'm Josh Levine, your host, founder of Great Mondays. We help executives from hypergrowth technology and social enterprise organizations build cultures that attract, engage, and retain top talent. If you'd like to be a guest on our program, hang out for about 20 minutes and I'll tell you how. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Great Mondays Radio. I have found my sister in arms here. Aoife O'Brien is the host of the Happier at Work podcast. And if there isn't a better pair to Great Mondays, I can't imagine what it would be. With a master's in organizational behavior and deep experience in market research, Aoife created Happier at Work, a consultancy helping leaders understand what people really need to stay, grow, and contribute at their best. And now she's an author. Her new book is out, Thriving Talent, How Great Leaders Drive Performance, Engagement, and Retention. Aoife O'Brien, all the way from Ireland, thank you so much for coming on Great Mondays Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Josh, and for that amazing introduction.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I think one of the questions I always like to think about when I see a book or talk to somebody about writing a book is, why did you have to do it? And it is not an easy thing to do. And so it just takes a lot of energy and effort. So you have to have this kind of really roaring internal fire to like finally be break into song in the form of printed pages in our digital, digitally abundant world. So when we are talking about this and your motivation, tell me what wasn't being said? What was missing that you're like, I am going to spend a year or more hold up writing a thing, right? Like, why did you have to do this?
It's such a good question. And it's probably answers a lot of things. Like, why did I spend 2 years doing the master's? Why did I start my business?
Yeah.
It all stemmed back originally to a toxic work environment that I found myself in. This was a place where I joined, and within 2 months, people were coming up to me and asking me questions, people who had been there for years. Mm. So on paper, it looked like I was doing really well and I was pleased with myself, and I was promised the elusive promotion to director level. So I was happy with my progression. Mm-hmm. And that promotion never materialized. And, I watched as it wasn't communicated to me. And I watched the managers in front of my desk gathering for their weekly meeting that I couldn't attend because I hadn't been promoted. Like, there was all of these things going on for me. And from that, I started asking questions. I started asking things like, what could I have done differently? What should leaders have done differently? What should HR have done differently? Mm. And that became the basis for the work that I do now. So it was out of that frustration that this thing came to life. I didn't have a background in HR or culture or anything, but I had a deep curiosity about understanding what makes us feel good at work.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, I think a lot of people come to culture in that same way, and they experience either a bad culture or a good culture, and understand the difference between the two, and that mm-hmm. learned experience, right? I or any professor could yap at you about the importance of culture, but until you actually feel it, like really feel it for good or ill, it just doesn't live, right? It just does. You don't get it. It feels mm-hmm. like to me.
Yeah. I think it was exacerbated by the fact that I had always come from cultures that I excelled in and that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
And I took it for granted. I think when you're in a positive culture, you don't know you're in a positive culture until you go into a negative culture and you realize the stark mm-hmm. difference between mm-hmm. what it means to really be thriving and feeling fulfilled through the work that you do, which, by the way, has an impact on the rest of our lives as well. You know, when you're happy at work, you're happy elsewhere, you have good health and you have good relationships. When you're not happy at work, when you're left thriving or when you're left surviving and floundering in
Crying,
a role and crying,
crying,
yes,
and yeah,
I definitely
surviving, not
found myself
thriving.
doing that on more than one occasion. But yeah, it has a negative impact on all aspects of our lives.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Let's start with, I mean, the book is states, you know, right up front about like this promise of thriving, but you're arguing that thriving isn't about motivation, it's not about perks, but about setting the conditions or redesigning the
Yeah.
conditions of the systems. What do you think is the thing that leaders often get unintentionally incorrect? Like, what are they? Because there is this like, it just, I don't believe that people are trying to be bad at it. They just aren't doing it well. So where do you land on that? What have you
Yeah.
seen?
I agree that I don't think leaders are deliberately doing this. They just don't know any better. And I think, you know, if I think about how I landed on this, it was initially the three aspects of I looked at values, I looked at needs, and I looked at strengths. Now that's since expanded to be focusing on workplace culture, drivers rather than needs, and capabilities rather than just focusing on strengths. And then I added a couple of pieces, which was psychological safety as the foundation and leadership as the capstone, because we need both of those elements as well. One of the things that I think most leaders get wrong is they assume that they have psychological safety. So I think if we're going to make any changes, if we're going to address anything at work, it's making sure that we've created the space for people to challenge what's going on, to speak up, to share their ideas. And I think we often assume that we have that because that's the default. We just think that we have it. I had an interesting conversation with Amy Edmondson on my podcast actually recently, and you know, she talks about it's the default is low or no psychological safety. And how to ascertain whether you have it is by having those conversations and challenging. And if everyone is silent, if no one is disagreeing with you, then you probably don't have psychological safety. And as leaders, it's kind of awkward to ask people to disagree with you. And it's awkward for them to challenge the boss as
Tell
well.
me how wrong
So,
I am, right? Like, I don't want
exactly.
that. Don't tell me that.
No one wants that, and therein lies the problem.
That's
So
right. That's
the
right.
bosses, from an ego perspective, we don't really want people to challenge and pick apart our ideas. But as individuals, we also don't want to be the one to challenge the boss.
What you're describing is it just occurred to me, it's almost like the default state in many cultures, maybe capital C cultures across the world, is a reverence or respect for the hierarchy. And the way that you're describing this symptom of not being able to challenge is the like the standard state. If you don't do anything, that is going to be the case. And they like so maybe we can think about this as it is a good sign if they can, and your job as a leader, as a manager, is to encourage that because it's not going to happen naturally.
That's exactly it. And Amy Edmondson talks about it being invisible. It's an invisible act. When people don't speak up, it's invisible. So you can't tell
It's the
that people are
absence.
not speaking up
That's
because
right.
by the
That's
very
right.
virtue that they're not
Not
speaking up.
speaking up. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Exactly. Okay, so we're going to encourage people to speak up. What is a behavior that will destroy psychological safety, even when intentions are good? Is there something in there that's like If our not speaking up is the absence of act, is there something in there that you've seen that leaders are doing that they could probably dial back on if they were aware of it?
I have two examples to share with you, Josh. One is a very personal example, happened to me. I was reasonably new into a role and I was working alongside a colleague. She wasn't my boss or anything like that. And I returned to Ireland. I had amassed a lot of global experience, and I thought I'll share this idea. And she turned to me and she said, "That's not how we do things around here. That's not how we do things around here." And I thought, oh, okay, I guess my ideas are not welcome, they're not valued. So that was a very quick way. And how many times do we repeat that, or that's not how things get done, or we've never tried that, or we've tried that before and it didn't work? So I think when we shoot down people's ideas, even if we have tried it before, I think it's a quick fire way to make sure that they don't share any more ideas. If we say, wow, that's a great idea, we did try it before, but maybe we could try it again, something like that.
Yeah, so
I have.
there's the welcoming of it, and then there's the actual idea, and how do you separate the two?
I think so, yeah. Like, and they do say there is no such thing as a stupid idea. And I think each idea, even if it's not the best one or the one that's selected, it can still give rise to another idea that someone else has. So I think they should all be welcome. And we shouldn't be precious about where ideas come from, because they can come from any different level within an organization. We don't have to default to the boss's idea. I had another more recent example as well that a client shared with me about return to office mandates. And not just return to office mandates, but actually on top of that, clocking in and clocking out feature in the office. So to me, that says immediately, we don't trust you to get the job done. And by the way, you have to come and do the job so we can see you doing the job. Like, that is an immediate erosion of trust. And just to kind of build on that point a little bit, the way I see work moving is, and we should all be thinking of this, it is very hard to do, but the mindset shift towards outcomes and impact rather than how much time we spend at work. And the difficulty with shifting this mindset to outcomes and impact is it requires us to think, it requires us to prioritize, it requires us to actually give a bit of time and think, what are we doing here? What are we trying to achieve? And what outcomes are the most important in order to help us to reach those goals? And it is such a difficult mindset shift to make, especially when we've up to now been so focused on the time that we spend at work and the energy that we put in. And again, if I can think of an example of this, a friend of mine said a few years ago, well, I worked 2 hours extra on Wednesday, therefore on Friday I can skip off out of the office 2 hours earlier. Like, that is not the kind of attitude that we want to have at work. It should be focusing on, here are the outcomes that I set out to achieve this week. And if I've achieved those outcomes by Thursday, fantastic. Maybe I don't need to work on Friday, or maybe I move on to my next set of priorities. But it shouldn't be about the number of hours that we work. But like I say, this is such a difficult mindset shift to make.
We've been doing it for so many years. It is a real, it is a concerted effort. And I would frame it up as it forces you to be more strategic
Yes.
with how you're working. And it feels today like there's so much pressure to tick the boxes to get things done. Even going back to I think one of the motivations of we don't, like your idea is not accepted. You're like, I have time for new ideas. We're just trying to get the old ideas implemented, right? So if you have to zoom out and you go, okay, take a deep breath. What am I trying to achieve? Then you're going to have more of that autonomy and thoughtful approach. And so it's hard enough as an individual, and I'll expand that to even a team, right? Or like, man, you're like, how are we all going to do this together? So that's it is a real big change. One of the other pieces that I think is really interesting, and it's a challenge that I have seen time and time again, is this an idea that you challenge in the book, which is that a lot of leaders think about focusing on the people stuff will slow performance down. What's happening here? Why are leaders misunderstanding that trait, or think about, they're even thinking about it like a trade-off, right? If we're doing this, we can't do this over here. It's going to slow us down. We've got some shit to do. See above, right?
See the list of things I have that I'm investing all of my time in. I think
Exactly.
leaders have that big challenge. And interestingly, one of my clients a few years ago, their big underlying question was, as leaders, how much time should we split between the day-to-day role and the people stuff? And like my response was kind of, it's sort of like a piece, you know, how long is a piece of string? There's no hard and fast rule about how much time you spend. And I understand that with people management comes the responsibility of meetings, the building relationships, the administration and dealing with people's stuff as and when it comes about. So there's all of that stuff as well. But I think the people side of business, and I didn't understand this until I got into this world. Like when I worked in corporate, I thought that's HR's problem. That's why the questions running through my head were, why aren't HR stepping in? Why aren't they doing something?
Why aren't they
But
doing
I
their
think
job?
it's why
Right?
am I doing HR's job as well as my own job? You know, management issues, that's something that HR can deal with. It's like, no, it's not. That actually rests with us as leaders. So I think we assume that it's going to take an awful lot of time when, in fact, what we could do is change how we're doing certain things. So, if I think about meetings, like when I think about the kinds of meetings I had with my teams when I worked in corporate, they weren't really that effective. You know, it was kind of like, here's a task update. But if I instead had used that as an opportunity to understand a little bit more about them, the kinds of things that drive them at work, the kinds of things that really light them up, the kinds of things that they would like to try more of, the things they enjoy most about their role, if we can switch up to focus and maybe it's a change of lens rather than an additional input of time, just change the way we think about these things and open our eyes a little bit to the talent that we have around us and how to activate that a little bit more.
Well, let's talk about the talent around us. One of the parts of your one of the pillars is this idea of capabilities. And I was when I first opened the book, I was surprised to see that term. I don't know, I can't tell you why I was surprised, but it struck me as something that I hadn't really thought through previously. So when what are we what are we talking about when we're talking about capabilities, and why is this a problem? Like, what is the there's obviously some problem that you've identified here. Let's talk about, this concept and how you got to it, and why it's continued to be so pervasive.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So when I first devised the framework, as I mentioned, the third pillar at that stage was strengths. And when I started writing the book, I thought, right, okay, I'm going to be focusing on strengths here. And I must say, this was the most interesting chapter, the most interesting section for me to write. There's three chapters within this capability section. And I think what interests me most is it's understanding at an individual level what our strengths are. Most people are not working in their area of strength. We do not talk about strengths at work. You might have a vague idea, like that person is really good on Excel, but we don't know fundamentally what they're really good at and what they could potentially do. So there's the kind of the current performance, but then the potential at an individual level. Then I also look at a team level. How do you find people who have complementary strengths with the recognition that's often these complementary strengths antagonize each other? So if you're working with someone, if you're like a big picture thinker and you're working with someone who's very detail oriented, you would be fantastic paired up together, but you would also antagonize each other. So it's recognizing that as well.
I'm feeling
But
that. That feels like a very personal affront. I
is
mean,
it a personal attack? I'm
that's
sorry,
yeah,
Josh.
no, that's all right. That's all right. That's exactly right. As I've gotten more mature, I have learned to really appreciate detailed thinkers, but it was not always the case. I'm like, what is wrong with this person? Why are they so annoying?
Exactly. And they
Yeah.
are probably thinking exactly the same thing about
Oh, they are
you.
definitely
And
thinking that about me.
this
Yeah.
is it. And I think a shared appreciation of the strengths that each person brings to the role, then, and how we can leverage this and how we can work together.
Yeah.
And then the third aspect is removing the blockers that we have that are getting in the way of us doing our best work. So that can be things like busy work. I'm so busy all the time that I don't have time to think about what I should be working on. The emails that get in the way that block up our inboxes that we feel like we must give an immediate response to. There is the meetings that we have that could have been an email. You know, all of these things are getting in the way of us being able to actually do our job. So it's all the things that get in the way day to day, and they take away our capability to be able to do our work effectively. And then at an organization-wide level, it's how do we leverage the systems that we operate in? How do we use automations? And now more recently, how do we use AI? And, you know, a recent conversation, it's like, how do we use AI without getting completely overwhelmed with all of the information that's at our fingertips? And I saw an interesting article in the Harvard Business Review recently as well, talking about AI work slop. So your colleague asks you
Yeah,
to produce
I
something,
saw that
you
too.
produce something with the help of AI that looks actually like top notch, looks really polished, you send that,
Yep.
and
You never
the
reviewed it.
receiver is left to decipher exactly what it means because it looks very fancy, but actually the substance is not there at all. And so they're, you know, cognitive overload trying to pick apart what are you trying to say here?
It is the work. The scourge of work jargon amplified, right? So work jargon,
Yes.
right? It's like there was a, I remember in the 2000s, there was like a whole like takedown of work jargon and why do we did it and what does it mean and you know, how do you decipher it? This is even more so. It's the same motivation. It looks great. It makes me look awesome, but I don't even know what the hell it means. Like I haven't put in the
Yes.
thoughtfulness. So
Yeah.
that is really interesting. When the other part of this that I thought was really interesting is your connection to how you're talking about capabilities, not just job titles, which is connecting very deeply to some of the other thinking and the writing I've been doing on my other podcast, which you should check out, called The Job Market Shit Show.
I have checked it out
Yeah,
already and I'm loving it so far.
the job market shit show on Substack. It's this idea of, you know, I guess from your perspective, right, and my personal interest is how do you navigate, how might we, if we're using the design thinking phraseology, how might we start to understand, not just understand for ourselves, but communicate what we are good at that doesn't have to do with a list of job titles and companies as symbols of we might be good at our job.
Yeah, really good question. And interestingly, I'm thinking that that could be a potential future book for me. I'm really interested in this area and understanding how strengths link with skills, but also as individuals, how do we articulate? And I'm doing that work for myself, but looking at multiple different layers. So, to give you an example, I've noticed that I really value things like efficiency. So I like things to be very efficient. And I had a conversation with someone yesterday. We were talking about systems and, business systems that we use. And I was like, I like systems because they create efficiency and I want to create efficiency. And I said, it occurred to me that maybe she doesn't value that. And I said, what do you like about systems? She said, I get to create something from scratch. So it's kind of finding those different layers of the reason behind why you like something. I've always been good at logic and methodology and maths and things like that. So that's how my brain works. I had a 20-year career in market research where I was taking data but translating that into insights for companies to change their marketing and sales plans. And so for me, it's the distillation of information and maybe seeing connections where others don't see connections. But I am trying to learn how do I articulate what do I do uniquely, but also in that quest for understanding what that means for me, how do I help other people to do that? So watch out, watch this space for like, I'm thinking it will have four different layers depending on who is it that you ultimately want to help. Do you want to help people or do you want to help things or do you want to help animals? Or thinking, what is the driver? Is it a driver for more efficiency? For example, like I have the driver. That there are things that exist out there at the minute, but they are very kind of one-dimensional. So just looking at a specific characteristic that you have. And there are some, if you just look up online, search for free strengths tests, you can take them online. There's some online that identify some of your unrealized strengths, which I think is quite interesting. And some, there's strengths that you have, but you don't use them enough. And then some of your, I can't remember the phrasing they use, but I don't think it's development area, but I also don't think it's weakness or anything like that
Right,
either.
growth,
It's maybe
growing
some of
edge. Yeah,
your
something like
growing
that.
edge, the things that maybe might get in the way. There's also another fantastic one that I always recommend called Sparky Type, which is spelt spark, then with an E and then TYPE.
Like
And I think you
archetype.
just go to the Sparky Type website.
Sparkotype.
And what I found from that, it explained a lot of my career because I found that I am a scientist, which is a problem solver. That's my primary Sparky Type. And I'm the Maven, which is my shadow Sparky Type, which means I gather knowledge. But I gather knowledge to solve problems. And I was like, well, that's what I've done my entire career. And so if I'm looking at the world through the lens of this problem solving, and there's 10 different Sparky types. Some people like to make things, some people like to educate people, some people like to lead and coach people. I like to solve problems. And that's kind of, I see everything as a problem that needs to be solved. And I mean that in a very positive way. I mean, if there's a problem to be solved, there's an opportunity here to make something, probably make something more efficient, but a problem nonetheless that can be solved and there's an opportunity.
This has been really fascinating. There's obviously a lot in here. I like to wrap up the episode asking for one actionable idea. So, if we're thinking about a leader taking one idea from your book in the next 90 days, what would give them the biggest oomph, the biggest return? What's the highest leverage point?
I think well, we touched on this idea of psychological safety already. So hopefully people have enough to do on that end. One of the other things that I think people get wrong is this idea of autonomy. We think if we just give people enough autonomy that they will be able to go and figure stuff out. But if you can give people autonomy with really clear direction and guidance, that will be a huge game changer. So set really clear expectations for people, but then give them the autonomy to do it how they
Well,
see
it
fit.
ties right back to our outcomes-based work, right? Like that's, I think,
Exactly.
exactly the thing. Amazing. Aoife O'Brien, the legendary Happier at Work podcast hostess, with the mostest. Thrivingtalentbook.com is where you can learn more about her book. She is also at happieratwork.ie. Her new book, Thriving Talent: How Great Leaders Drive Performance, Engagement, and Retention. She is coming to the United States to do a book tour. I don't know how quick it is. So I am going to follow along. I will definitely repost and announce Aoife's tour on my LinkedIn. And you should follow Aoife as well. I'm sure she will be announcing it so that you don't miss it. We're very excited to have her over here. Aoife O'Brien, thanks for coming on Great Mondays Radio to share a little bit more about the Thriving Talent Framework and some of your hard-earned wisdom. It was so wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Josh. I really, really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Great Mondays Radio. Hey, if you want to be a guest, head over to radio.greatmondays.com. And if you think this episode was interesting and your friends and fans would enjoy it, please share on social media. And if you want to get more people to understand the power of company culture in business today, please rate and review Great Mondays Radio on your podcast feed. It really helps us reach more people. If you want to hear more candid conversations with culture leaders, subscribe to Great Mondays Radio. I'd love to connect with you. Find me on LinkedIn at AKA Josh Levine, on YouTube at Great Mondays, and you can always email me, josh@greatmondays.com. Find out more about our work with hypergrowth technology and social enterprise organizations at greatmondays.com. I'm Josh Levine. Thanks for listening to Great Mondays Radio.